This program is copyright 1995 by National Vanguard Books. Post Office Box 330, Hillsboro, West Virginia, 24946. All rights reserved.
And pompously warning that he would treat with equal ruthlessness any other racists who fell into his hands. When he arrived home that night after his TV interview, he found his wife on the living room floor with her throat cut. 2 days later, his patrol car was ambushed. His bullet-riddled body was found in its burned-out wreckage. It is a terrible thing to kill women of our own race, but we are engaged in a war in which all the old rules have been scrapped. We are in a war to the death with the Jew, who now feels himself so close to his final victory that he can safely drop his mask and treat his enemies as the cattle his religion tells him they are. Our retribution against the sheriff here should serve as a warning to the Jews' Gentile henchmen, at least, that if they adopt the Jews' attitude toward our women and children, then they cannot expect their own families to be safe. At this point is inserted an editorial note to the reader. Several sets of books containing the Jewish religious doctrine, which was called Judaism, are still extant today. These books, the Talmud and the Torah, do indeed refer to non-Jews as cattle. Especially horrifying to us is the attitude the Jews had toward non-Jewish women. The word they used to designate a girl of our race was shiksa, which was derived from the Hebrew word meaning both abomination and non-kosher meat, or unclean meat. The next diary entry is dated June 21st. I was stopped at a police roadblock driving back from Boulder tonight. No problem getting through it. They just checked my driver's license, that is, the late and unlamented David S. Bloom's license, asked me where I was going, and took a quick look in the car. But the roadblock had traffic backed up for miles, and other motorists were really fuming. One of them told me this is the first time they've used roadblocks in this area. The roadblock and a couple of hints I've caught on news broadcasts in the last few days lead me to believe that the system knows something big is cooking. I hope they don't tighten up security out here the way they have back on the East Coast. It'll mess up our plans if they do. On the other hand, it'll do these bumpkins around here a lot of good to get a full dose of Big Brother's loving care. Most of them hardly ever see a black or a Jew, and they act as if there's not a war going on. They seem to think that they are far enough away from the things that are plaguing other parts of the country that they can keep on with their same old routine. They resent any hint that they may have to halt their pursuit of pleasure and affluence long enough to cut a cancer out of America that will surely destroy us all if it's not eliminated soon. But it's always been that way with Bubus Americanus. I'm quite concerned that I've heard no news of Evanston. I've been expecting the raid there every day since the last week of last month. Has there been more trouble with Harrison? Or has Revolutionary Command decided to postpone the Evanston raid, perhaps until our big offensive next month? There was no indication of such a postponement on my last briefing. More than likely, the trouble is Harrison, damn him. When I recalculated the hit probability on the target at the range given me by our Chicago mortar team just before I left Washington for Dallas, I decided we should distribute our radioactive contaminant among 5 rounds instead of only 3. That gives us a probability of nearly 90% that we'll get 1 or more rounds into the generator building. But Harrison may have balked at having to handle so much ordnance. If that's the case, why hasn't someone told me? I'm also becoming concerned that I've received no orders as to what I'm to do when I finish my work here next week. If I don't get back to Washington then, I'm afraid I may not make it before the big push starts. I want to be back there with Catherine and the others when everything hits the fan next month. And I can't see any reason why I shouldn't, because there will hardly be time to send me anywhere else to set up another training course in special ordnance. The next diary entry is dated June 27th, 1993. So I finally have my orders. It's to be California for me during our big summer offensive. At first I was very disappointed that I won't be able to go back to Washington, but the more I consider the implications of some of the things I was told this afternoon, the more I'm convinced that the real focus of our activity in the next few weeks will be on the West Coast. It looks like I'll be in the thick of things there, and that will be a welcome change from all this classroom work, at least. Denver Field Command summoned me and six of my pupils to a meeting today on 2 hours' notice. We were told almost nothing, except that I and four of the others are to be in Los Angeles by Wednesday night at the latest. The last two were given a destination in San Mateo, just outside San Francisco. I protested immediately and vehemently. All these people have been trained especially to attack specific targets in this area, and they've been trained as teams. It doesn't make sense to break them up now and send some of them to California when they can be so much more effective here. If they're sent away, our whole program for the Rocky Mountain area will be jeopardized. The two Denver Field Command officers at the meeting assured me that their decision had not been made capriciously and that they are fully cognizant of the validity of my objections, but that more pressing considerations must prevail. I finally forced them to reveal that they had received an urgent order from Revolutionary Command to transfer every activist they could spare to the West Coast immediately. Apparently, other field commands all over the country have received similar orders. They were reluctant to say more, but from the emphasis they put on our deadline for reporting to our California destinations, I strongly suspect that things are set to blow sometime next week. I did accomplish one thing this afternoon. I arranged to have Albert Mason, who was to go to San Mateo, but whose presence here is really essential to the success of the operations planned for this area, swapped for another man. But I had trouble gaining even that concession. I insisted on knowing exactly what criteria had been used in selecting the men to be transferred. It turned out that, except in my case, there were two: infantry combat experience and rifle marksmanship, which makes it look like they want snipers and barricade fighters out on the coast rather than saboteurs and demolition experts. Al, it is true, qualified as an expert with the rifle when he was in the service, and he spent 3 years as a squad leader in Southeast Asia. At this point, there is inserted an editorial note to the reader. Turner is referring to the so-called Vietnam War, which had been over for 2 decades at the time, but which played an enormously important role in laying the groundwork for the organization's later success in dealing with the system's armed forces. Now the text continues. But he has also been my best pupil here. He is the one man I spent time with explaining some of the newer military gadgets we expect to acquire in our raids on the arsenals around here. He is the only one I am sure will be able to use the new M58 laser rangefinders, for example, and teach our mortar teams how to use them too. And he is also the only one here to whom I taught enough basic electronics so that he can rig up the radio-controlled detonators, which are an essential part of our plan for knocking out the highway network in this area and keeping it knocked out. Only when I pointed out these things to Denver Field Command did they agree to let Al stay here. We then spent half an hour going over a list of all the other activists here before we found one I thought could go to California in Al's place without jeopardizing things here and who also satisfied their criteria. My impression is that everything we planned for this area is still go, and it is still considered important for us to achieve our objectives here. But the really critical theater of operations will be the West Coast. We are approximately doubling our manpower there with these last-minute transfers, but we are doing it in such a way that at least most of the operations planned for other areas can go ahead, though with fewer personnel. Well, we only have 48 hours to drive more than 1,000 miles, and there's no telling how many checkpoints we'll be stopped at. The others will be by to pick me up in about 2 hours, and then it'll take me at least 4 hours to pack my gadgets in the car so that they won't be found if we're searched. I think I'll take a quick nap now. The next diary entry is dated July 1st. Wow, are things tense here. We arrived yesterday around 1 in the morning after a trip I'd just as soon forget. The others are dispersed to their assigned units, but I'm staying with Los Angeles Northwest Field Command temporarily in a place called Canoga Park, about 20 miles northwest of Los Angeles proper. It is apparent that the organization is much more solidly entrenched here than elsewhere, simply from the fact that there are 8 different field commands in the Los Angeles metropolitan area, whereas 1 suffices for most other major cities in the country. That would indicate an underground membership here in the 500 to 700 range. Mostly, I've been catching up on my sleep since I arrived, but the other people here don't seem to be doing any sleeping at all. Couriers are constantly coming and going, and conferences are being held at all hours. This evening, I finally buttonholed someone and got at least a partial briefing on the situation. A simultaneous assault on more than 600 military and civilian targets all over the country has been scheduled for next Monday morning, July 4th. Unfortunately, however, one of our members here was picked up by the police on Wednesday, just a few hours before our arrival. It seems to have been just a fluke. He was stopped on the street for a routine identification check, and the cops became suspicious about something. Since the man is not in the order, he was neither prepared nor under an absolute obligation to kill himself if captured. The great worry for the last 2 days has been that, under torture, he will reveal enough of what he knows to tip off the system to the fact that a major assault is scheduled for Monday. Then, even though the authorities won't know just which targets we plan to hit, they'll tighten up security everywhere to the point that our casualties will be unbearably high. Revolutionary Command has 2 choices: silence our man before he can be interrogated, or reschedule our entire offensive. The latter choice is almost unthinkable. Too many things have been carefully arranged and synchronized in detail for next Monday to allow the date to be advanced, and a postponement might run into months, with enormous risks attendant on having so many people already primed for Monday, knowing so much for so long. So it was decided yesterday to act on the first choice. But even that presents a major problem. We can't hit our man here in Los Angeles without risking blowing the cover of one of our most valuable legals, a special agent in the FBI's Los Angeles office. That's because the prisoner is being held in a location which is supposed to be a big secret. If we raid the place, they'll only have 6 people to suspect as the one who leaked the information to us. The system's customary procedure when they pick up one of our people is to perform only a very cursory interrogation in the field, just enough to determine whether there is any indication that the prisoner is connected in any way with the organization. If there is, then he is flown back to Washington for a thorough working over by their Israeli torture specialists, and the latter is what we can't afford to let happen. The interesting thing in this particular case, and the thing which has kept Revolutionary Command in a state of agonized indecision for 2 days now, is that the FBI has been holding the prisoner here instead of flying him back to the Washington headquarters Thursday morning as soon as they suspected they had an organization member. No one seems to know exactly why, not even our FBI legal. It may just be an instance of organizational inefficiency on their part. Or perhaps they're bringing an interrogation team out here from Washington this time, contrary to their previous routine. Anyway, Revolutionary Command has decided to hold off on the hit and see what happens. If no move is made to put the prisoner on a plane for Washington or to interrogate him further here within the next 36 hours, the problem will be solved. Any information the system extracts from him will come too late to interfere with our Monday schedule. But if a transfer or an interrogation seems imminent before Sunday afternoon, we're prepared to launch a lightning raid on the FBI's secret prison here, even at the risk of losing our inside man in the local FBI office, whose information in coming months can be invaluable to us. As for me, I still don't know why I'm here or what I'm supposed to do, and I'm not sure anyone else does either. I was just told to wait. Well, I guess we're really facing a major test again, like we did in September 1991. It just seems incredible to me that the organization is actually launching an all-out assault on the system in 2 days. The total number of men we can put on the firing line for the whole country can't be more than 1,500, despite the very rapid gains in recruiting we've made in the last few months. Altogether, including our support personnel, our female members, and our legals, our strength can't possibly exceed 5,000 people. And I'd estimate that nearly a third of them are concentrated here in California now. It just seems unreal, like a gnat planning to assassinate an elephant. Of course, we're not expecting the system to collapse Monday. If it did, we wouldn't know how to cope with the situation, because the organization is still far too small to take over the running of the country and the rebuilding of American society. We'll need an infrastructure 100 times as large as we have now to even begin tackling that job. What we'll do Monday is escalate the conflict to a new level and forestall the system's latest strategy for dealing with us. We really have no choice in the matter. If the organization is to survive and continue growing under the very difficult circumstances which have been imposed on us, we must maintain our momentum, especially our psychological momentum. The danger in not constantly escalating the war is that the system will find a new equilibrium and the public will become accustomed to it. The only way to maintain the present influx of recruits is to keep a substantial portion of the public psychologically off balance. Keep them at least half convinced that the system isn't strong enough and efficient enough to wipe us out, that we are an irresistible force, that sooner or later the war will sweep them too up in it. Otherwise, the worthless bastards will take the easy way out by just sitting back to see what happens. The American people have already proved that they can shamelessly continue their crass pursuit of pleasure under the most provocative conditions imaginable, so long as the new provocations are introduced gradually enough for them to become accustomed to them. That's our greatest danger in not acting. Besides that, however, the political police are continually tightening the screws. Despite our extraordinary security procedures, they will eventually succeed in penetrating the organization and wrecking us, if we give them time. And it's becoming harder all the time for us to move around without being picked up. Very soon now, the new internal passport system, which we wrecked more than a year ago, will be back on the tracks, twice as mean as before. I don't know how we'll survive when that becomes operational. Thinking back over the last 2 years, though, it's amazing that we've survived even until now. There have been 100 times when I didn't know how we'd be able to last another month. Part of the reason we've been able to make it this far is something for which we really can't take credit, and that's the inefficiency of the system. They've made some bad mistakes and failed to follow up on a lot of things which could have hurt us badly. One gets the impression that, except for the Jews who are really burning the midnight oil in their efforts against us, the rest of the system is a bunch of clock watchers. Thank equal opportunity and all those niggers in the FBI and the Army for that. The system has become so corrupt and so mongrelized that only the Jews feel at home in it, and no one feels any loyalty toward it. But a bigger part of the reason is the way we've adapted to our peculiar circumstances. In just 2 years, the organization has learned a whole new way of existence. We're doing a number of things now which are absolutely vital to our survival, but to which we had given almost no thought 2 years ago. Our interrogation technique for checking out new recruits, for example. There's no way we could have lasted this long without that, and we didn't develop it until we absolutely had to have it. What we would have done without Dr. Clark to work out the technique, I don't know. And then there's the matter of false identities. We had only the vaguest ideas about coping with this problem when we first went underground. Now we have a number of specialized units who do nothing but provide nearly foolproof false identities for our activists. They are real professionals, but they've had to learn their rather gruesome trade in a hurry. And money. What a problem that was in the beginning. Having to count our pennies affected our whole psychology. It made us think small. So far as I know, no one in the organization had ever given any serious thought to the problem of financing an underground movement before the problem became crucial. Then we learned the counterfeiting trade. It was providential that we had someone in the organization with the requisite technical knowledge, of course, but we still had to set up our distribution network for getting the counterfeit bills into circulation after we had printed them. In just the last few months, this accomplishment has made an enormous difference for all of us. Having a ready supply of cash, being able to buy whatever we need instead of hijacking it as in the old days, has made things much easier. It has given us greater mobility and greater safety. There's been a certain element of luck in our success so far, and there's no doubt that Revolutionary Command has been doing a pretty good job of generalship. We've had good planning, a good strategy, but more than that, we've shown the ability to meet new challenges and solve new problems. We've remained flexible. I think the history of the organization proves that no one can make a fixed plan for a revolution and then stick to it. The future is always too uncertain. One can never be sure how a given situation will develop. And totally unexpected things are always happening, things that no planner, however thorough, could have foreseen. So in order to be successful, a revolutionary must always be ready to adapt to new circumstances and take advantage of new opportunities. Our record in that regard is reassuring, but I cannot help being apprehensive about next week. I'm sure we will knock hell out of the bastards Monday. We will throw a good-sized monkey wrench into the country's economic machinery if only half of the things we have planned come off successfully. And we'll force the system into a state of total mobilization with the resulting psychological shock to the general public. But what then? What about next month and the month after that? We're throwing everything we've got into next week's offensive, and there is just no way we can keep up that level of activity for more than a few days. We are stretched too thin everywhere. And yet, my instinct tells me that the organization is not acting purely from desperation now. We are not making one last desperate effort to wreck the system Monday. At least, I hope not. If we make an all-out effort, then have to retrench when it fails, as it surely will, the psychological effect will be as lethal for us as it will be helpful for the system. So Revolutionary Command must have something up its sleeve I don't know about. I am sure the heavy concentration of our people in California is a clue, but I can't figure it out. The next diary entry is dated July 7th, 1993. Looks like I'll be here till morning, so I can take an hour or so now to record the events of the last few days. This is really a swanky place. It's a penthouse apartment from which we can see most of Los Angeles, which is why we're using it as a command post. But the luxury is unbelievable. Satin sheets, genuine fur bedspreads, gold-plated bathroom fixtures, wall taps which dispense bourbon, scotch, and vodka in every room, huge framed pornographic photographs on the walls. The apartment belonged to one Jerry Siegelbaum, a business agent for the local Municipal Employees Union, and the star subject of the dirty photos on the walls. Looks like he preferred blonde Gentile girls, although his partner in one picture is a Negress, and he's with a young boy in another. Some representative of the workers he was. I hope someone moves him from the hallway outside soon. There's been no air conditioning since Monday, and he's beginning to stink pretty bad. This huge city presents quite a different aspect now from the last time I had an overall view of it at night. The blaze of lights outlining all the main streets is gone. Instead, the general blackness is broken only by hundreds of fires randomly scattered through the city. I know there are thousands of vehicles moving down there, but they are driving without lights, so they won't be shot at. For the last 4 days, one has heard the practically continuous scream of sirens from police and emergency vehicles, mixed with the sound of gunfire and explosions and the whirring clatter of helicopters. Tonight there is only the gunfire, and not much of that. It looks like the battle here has reached a decisive stage. At 2:00 Monday morning, more than 60 of our combat units struck simultaneously throughout the Los Angeles area, while hundreds of other units hit targets all across the country, from Canada to Mexico and from coast to coast. I haven't heard yet what we accomplished elsewhere, because the system has clamped a total censorship on all the news media, the ones we haven't seized ourselves, that is. And I haven't had a chance to talk to any of our own people who've been in contact with Revolutionary Command. But here in Los Angeles, we've done surprisingly well. Our initial assault cut off all water and electrical power into the metropolitan area, knocked out the main airports, and made all the major freeways impassable. We took out the telephone exchanges and blew up every gasoline storage depot. The harbor area has been almost a solid mass of flames for 4 days now. We seized at least 15 police stations. Mostly, we just took their weapons, destroyed their communications equipment and whatever vehicles were not on patrol at the time, and then pulled out. But apparently, our people are still holed up in several police buildings and are using them as local command posts. At first, the cops and the firemen were running around like chickens with their heads cut off, sirens and flashing lights everywhere. By Monday afternoon, however, communications had broken down so badly, and there were so many fires and other emergencies, that the police and fire departments were being much more selective in their responses. In many areas, our teams were able to go about their work practically without interference. Now, of course, most emergency and police vehicles are out of fuel and can't move at all, and the ones which still have gas seem to be lying low. The whole key to neutralizing the police, and to everything else for that matter, was our work inside the military. It was apparent to everyone as early as Monday afternoon that something big was happening inside the military establishment. For one thing, other than the troops and tanks guarding power stations, TV transmitters, and so on, as always, no military units were deployed against us. For another thing, there were obvious signs of armed conflict inside all the military bases in the area. We could see and hear jet fighter bombers swooping low over the city, but they were not attacking us, at least not directly. They were strafing and bombing the dozen or so California National Guard armories in the metropolitan area. Those jets were apparently from El Toro Marine Air Station south of here. Later, we saw several dogfights in the sky over Los Angeles and heard that Camp Pendleton, the big Marine Corps base about 70 miles southeast of here, was being hit by heavy bombers from Edwards Air Force Base. All in all, a very confusing scenario for everyone concerned. But Monday evening, quite by chance, I ran into Henry, of all people, and he explained quite a bit of the military situation to me. Good old Henry, how glad I was to see him again. We met in the KNX transmitter building, where I was helping our broadcast team get the station back on the air after we seized it. That, by the way, is what I've been doing for 4 days, repairing shot-up transmitters, shifting transmitter frequencies, and improvising equipment. We now have one FM station and two AM stations on the air, all operating from emergency generators. In all three cases, we cut the cables from the studios and installed our broadcast teams directly at the transmitter sites. Henry came roaring up to KNX in a Jeep, wearing a U.S. Army uniform with colonel's insignia, and accompanied by three soldiers carrying machine guns and anti-tank rockets. He was bringing the text to be broadcast, a text directed primarily at military personnel. As soon as I had finished splicing our microphone and audio equipment into the transmitter input, Henry and I stepped to the side to talk while his message was being read over the air by our announcer. It consisted of an appeal to all white military personnel who had not already done so, to join our revolution, together with a warning to those who failed to heed the appeal. The message was very well designed, and I am sure its effect on both military and civilian listeners was powerful. Henry, it turned out, has been in charge of the organization's entire recruiting effort in the armed forces for over a year, and he has been concentrating his efforts on the West Coast since he was transferred here last March. The story he told me was a long one, but together with what I have learned since then, its essence is this. We've been recruiting inside the military on two levels since the organization was formed. At the lower level, we operated semi-openly before September 1991 and clandestinely afterwards. That involved the dissemination of our propaganda among enlisted personnel and non-coms, mostly on a person-to-person basis. But, Henry told me, we have also been recruiting at higher levels, in the utmost secrecy. Revolutionary Command's strategy hinged on our success in winning over a number of high-ranking military commanders, and on Monday we began playing that hidden trump. That's why the armed forces haven't been used against us, and also why the various military units have been shooting and bombing each other the last 4 days. The intra-military conflict started with units commanded by our sympathizers on one side, and those loyal to the system, by far the majority, on the other side. Another aspect to the conflict soon developed and overshadowed the first, however, black against white. Military units commanded by pro-organization officers began disarming all black military personnel as soon as we launched our Monday morning attack. The excuse they used was that black militants had launched a mutiny in other units and that their orders from higher up were to disarm all blacks to prevent the spread of the mutiny. Generally, white servicemen were ready and willing to believe that story and did not need to be told twice to turn their guns against the blacks in their units. Those few whose liberal predispositions made them hesitate were shot on the spot. In other units, our enlisted personnel simply began shooting any blacks they saw in uniform and then deserted to units commanded by our sympathizers. The blacks, naturally enough, reacted in such a way as to make the story about a black mutiny come true. Even in those units commanded by pro-system officers, heavy fighting between blacks and whites broke out. And since some of these units are nearly half black, the fighting has been bloody and prolonged. The result has been that, although the units commanded by our sympathizers initially had only about 5% of the strength of the pro-system units, most of the latter have been paralyzed by internal fighting between blacks and whites. And now whites are coming over in increasing numbers to our units because of this. Our broadcasts have helped this process along greatly. We have exaggerated our own strength, of course, and have told white servicemen who want to join our units where to go. And to help convince them, as well as to keep the niggers spooked and doing their thing, we have turned one of our transmitters into a phony soul station and been broadcasting a call for black revolution, telling the blacks to shoot their white officers and non-coms before the whites can disarm them. About the only military units in the Los Angeles area able to offer any effective opposition to us have been some Air Force fighter and bomber units and the Marine Air Unit at El Toro. They've been attacking military units believed to have come over to us. But, according to Henry, they have been doing about as much damage to the pro-system forces as to ours. Henry chuckled as he explained to me that the organization had been unable to make sufficient headway in its recruiting in the California National Guard to be able to count on any Guard units coming over to us. So the organization kidnapped the local Guard commander, General Howell, just before the Monday morning attack as a preventive measure. When the system couldn't locate Howell, they were apparently afraid he had joined us. Their fears were undoubtedly confirmed when they heard that he had hurriedly left his home with three strangers after midnight Monday, less than an hour before everything hit the fan. Anyway, their suspicions got the better of them, and so they ordered all the National Guard armories and depots bombed by loyal air units Monday afternoon. And at Camp Pendleton, we were nowhere near having the upper hand before the system panicked and ordered in the bombers. I'm sure that move is what tilted things in our favor. There is still heavy fighting in the Pendleton area, but we are apparently on top there now. I don't know from which base the column of tanks came that neutralized the main Los Angeles police headquarters for us today, but they were certainly a godsend. We never could have done it without them. From the beginning, the L.A. cops have been our only really organized opposition. The smaller police forces in surrounding jurisdictions have not been a particular problem. Some we knocked out of action completely. Others decided to lie low and mind their own business after a few early skirmishes. But the 10,000 or so men in the Los Angeles Police Department were very much in action against us until only a few hours ago, and the going was very rough. We've had at least 100 KIAs here in the last 4 days, between 15% and 20% of our local combat strength. I don't know why we failed to do the same thing with the police here we seem to have done with the military. Perhaps it was just a shortage of cadres on our part, and military recruiting was given a higher priority than police recruiting. In any event, the main police headquarters here almost immediately became the center of counter-revolutionary resistance. The L.A. City cops were joined by some sheriff's units from the county, and even by some state highway patrol units, and they turned their main headquarters building into a fortress that was impregnable to anything we could bring to bear against it. In fact, it was almost certain death for any of our people to venture within a couple of blocks of the place. They had a large store of fuel, more than 1,000 vehicles, and emergency power for their communications equipment, and they outmanned us by a large factor. Using helicopters for reconnaissance, they pinpointed our various strong points and the buildings we had seized, and they sent out raiding parties involving as many as 50 vehicles and 200 to 300 men. Our demolition of virtually every highway overpass had limited their mobility to a large extent, but their airborne observers were able to route them around many obstacles. We managed to protect certain really vital points, including the radio stations we had seized, only by having well-dug-in machine gun crews covering the avenues of approach. Fortunately, the cops had only a few armored vehicles, because most of our people had no weapons for dealing with armor. It was only today that anti-tank weapons became generally available to our combat teams. If the L.A. cops had been able to link up with any military units remaining loyal to the system, that would have been the end of us. Fortunately, a dozen old M-60s from a unit which had come over to us got to them first. They rolled right over the roadblocks the police had set up around their headquarters, riddled the building with high explosive and incendiary shells, and liberally sprayed the hundreds of police vehicles in the area with machine gun fire. The cops' communications and power were knocked out, and their building was set afire in a dozen places. They had to evacuate the building, and we rained 81-millimeter mortar fire down on the surrounding parking lots and streets until the area became untenable for them. The place is deserted now and still burning. Most of the cops seem to have made their way to their homes and changed into civilian clothes. Now that most of the organized resistance against us here has been neutralized, everything hinges on whether we can get this area effectively under our control before military units from other parts of the country are sent in. I don't understand why that hasn't already happened. I was told just a couple of hours ago to report in the morning to a group of our technical people who will have the task of planning the details of restoring some electrical power and some water to the area, reestablishing routes for vehicular traffic, and locating and securing all remaining supplies of gasoline and diesel fuel. Sounds like more of a job for a civil engineer than for me. It also sounds a little premature, but it is encouraging to know that Revolutionary Command seems to be confident of the future. Perhaps I'll find out more about the overall situation tomorrow. The next diary entry is dated July 10th. Well, well, well. Things have really been happening. Some good things and some bad things, but mostly good so far. The military and police situation seems to be essentially under control here, and in fact for most of the West Coast, although there is apparently a lot of fighting still going on around San Francisco and in a few other areas. And there are still a few armed groups here, some cops and some military personnel, roving around and causing a little mischief. But we've secured all the bases and military airfields here, and we'll round up stray personnel in another day or two. The order is out now to shoot on sight anyone carrying arms, unless he is wearing one of our armbands. That's a welcome switch from a few days ago, when we were the ones liable to be shot on sight. After years of hiding, slinking around in disguises, and getting sick with fear every time we saw a cop, it's a wonderful feeling to be out in the open and to be the ones with the guns. The big problem here has become a civilian one. The civilian population has gone completely amok. Actually, one can hardly blame them, and I'm surprised they behaved themselves more or less as long as they did. After all, they've been without electric power and without a water supply for a week. A very substantial portion of them have also been without food for several days. For the first couple of days, Monday and Tuesday, the civilian population did just what we expected them to do. Hundreds of thousands of them piled into their cars and onto the freeways. They couldn't go very far, of course, because we had blown up a number of key interchanges, but they did manage to create a collection of the most monumental traffic jams imaginable, thus finishing our task for us of making ground travel almost impossible for the police. By Tuesday afternoon, most of the white population had returned to their homes, or at least to their own neighborhoods, many of them leaving their stalled cars on the roads and hiking back. They had discovered, first, that there was no feasible way for them to leave the Los Angeles area by automobile. Second, that they couldn't buy gasoline because the electric pumps at the filling stations weren't working. Third, that most stores and businesses were closed up tight. And fourth, that something really big was happening. They stayed home, kept their transistor radios on, and worried. There was remarkably little crime or violence except in the black areas, where rioting, looting, and burning began early Monday afternoon and grew progressively more intense and widespread. By early Thursday, however, there was a good bit of looting in white areas as well, mostly of grocery stores. Some people had not eaten for more than 48 hours by then and were acting more from desperation rather than lawlessness. Since it wasn't until Thursday night that we began to feel sure we had the police licked, we did nothing to discourage civilian disorder. The more of them in the streets, hungry and desperate, smashing store windows and stealing food, looking for drinkable water and fresh batteries for their radios, getting into fights with other people looking for the same things, the less time the police had for us. That, of course, was the principal idea behind our knocking out power, water, and transportation at the very beginning. If the police had had only us to cope with, we couldn't have won. But they couldn't handle us and a general breakdown of public order at the same time. Now, however, we're the ones with the job of restoring order, and it's going to be a bitch. The people are absolutely out of their minds with fear and panic. They are behaving in an entirely irrational manner, and a great number of lives are bound to be sacrificed before we get things under control. Partly, I'm afraid, starvation and exhaustion are going to have to do it for us, because our manpower and other material resources are entirely inadequate for the task. Today I went out with a fuel recovery team, and I got a close look at our civilian problem. It really shook me. We were driving a big gasoline tank truck with an armed Jeep escort from filling station to filling station in the Pasadena area, pumping the gasoline out of each station's tanks and into our truck. There's enough fuel in the area to meet our own needs for quite a while, but the civilians are going to have to get along without their cars for the duration. Pasadena used to be mostly white a few years ago, but it has become substantially black now. In the black areas, whenever we ran into blacks near a filling station, we simply opened fire on them to keep them at a distance. In the white areas, we were mobbed by hungry whites begging us for food, which, of course, we didn't have to give them. It's a damned good thing they have no firearms, or we'd be in a hell of a jam now. Thank you, Senator Cohen. Whoops, no more time to write now. Have to go to a meeting. We should get a briefing there on the national situation. The next diary entry is dated July 11th, 1993. Busy day. We've got some electrical power coming back into the area now from one of the hydroelectric plants up north, but not much. Electricity has to be strictly rationed, and I spent all day mapping out the sections of the metropolitan area which were to be energized and then dispatching teams to cut or switch out power lines and reconnect others. Later, if the rationing is successful, we may also provide power to some other sections. Last night, I found out why Washington hasn't tried to send troops in here from other parts of the country. It's because we've got Vandenberg Air Force Base and all the missile silos there. For the first 48 hours after our Monday morning attack last week, the system was in such a panic and the military situation was so uncertain that no major troop movements were possible, although we were spread so thin that there was no hope of seizing and holding territory anywhere except here on the West Coast. We did create an enormous amount of disruption, disorder, and confusion everywhere. Our people inside the military and other parts of the country had been instructed to carry out actions calculated to temporarily paralyze their units. This involved some sabotage, arson, and demolition, but to a much greater extent, it involved selective shootings. In units with a high quota of non-whites, our people shot down blacks at random, shouting slogans such as "White Power," with the deliberate intention of provoking a black reaction. This was followed up by the same tactic which we used here so successfully, seizing radio stations and broadcasting spurious calls for blacks to turn their guns against their white officers. In other units, communication centers were seized and messages sent which created the false impression that the units had come over to us. On top of all that, we wreaked real havoc on the civilian population. Power plants, communication facilities, dams, key highway interchanges, tank farms, gas pipelines, and everything else that could be blown up or burned down was hit Monday morning in an all-out effort all across the country to cause civilian panic and keep the system temporarily occupied with the attendant problems. I also learned that, along with everything else, the raid on the Evanston Project took place Monday morning. I was immensely pleased to hear that it was a complete success. So the net result was that by the time the system had assessed the situation and had regained enough confidence in the loyalty of any of its military units to try to move against us, we had finished mopping up Vandenberg and had issued our ultimatum. Any military move against us would result in our launching nuclear missiles targeted on New York City and Tel Aviv. And that's why things have been so quiet for the last few days. And now I understand Revolutionary Command's whole strategy, which had eluded me for so long and caused me so many misgivings. Revolutionary Command realized all along that there was no way, with our present numbers, that we could sustain a military assault against the system on a large enough scale for a long enough time to bring it down. We could have continued our guerrilla campaign of economic sabotage and psychological warfare for quite a while, of course, but time was ultimately on the side of the system. Unless we could make some really dramatic breakthrough, which would increase our numbers substantially, the system's growing police powers would eventually paralyze us. Well, we've made the breakthrough now, and we've got the potential, at least, for some very substantial growth. There are some 12 million people under our control in the Los Angeles metropolitan area alone. How large the total population base we have to draw from is still not clear because of the anomalous situation in Northern California. Under direct organization control at this moment is a strip of California which runs from the Mexican border to about 150 miles northwest of Los Angeles, and from the coast inland for a distance varying from 50 to 100 miles. Included in this strip are San Diego, Los Angeles, and all-important Vandenberg Air Force Base. The Sierras and the Mojave Desert form a natural eastern boundary to our territory. In a further coastal strip, which runs almost to the Oregon border and includes San Francisco and Sacramento, an anti-system military faction seems to be running things, but I gather that our own authority has not yet been established there. And the states of Oregon and Washington appear to be still firmly under system control, contrary to earlier rumors. Elsewhere in the country, things are in a general uproar, and our hit-and-run raids are continuing, but the system is in no immediate danger of collapsing. The main problem worrying the government seems to be whether or not it can trust its own armed forces. As a consequence of this worry, troops in some areas are still confined to their bases, even though they are badly needed to restore order among the civilian population. In some of the worst areas of civilian rioting, primarily because of the disruption of food supplies, the government is using special military units made up of non-whites only. They've rushed some of these all-nigger units into the border area around our California enclave. The closest such unit seems to be in Barstow, about 100 miles northwest of here. Some white refugees from there have been trickling into our area, and their reports are pretty sickening. Mass rape and terror from the black troops, who are lording it over the local whites. I hate to hear of such things happening to white people, but the reaction can only be favorable to us, and it's good that we've forced the system to show its lack of confidence in the loyalty of the white population and its dependence on non-white elements. What's most important to us now, though, is that the government isn't trying to force its way into our territory. Our Vandenberg threat is holding them off for the moment, although that situation certainly won't last forever. But at least it gives us a chance to try to get our civilian population under control here. And what a mess things are in. There are more fires than ever, and rioting has become widespread. We simply don't have enough people, even including all the military personnel nominally on our side now, to maintain order while we restore essential utilities and set up an emergency food distribution system. We have altogether about 40,000 armed forces personnel at our disposal, nearly two-thirds of them in the metro area here, and the other third scattered from San Diego to Vandenberg. It is a ticklish situation, though, because they outnumber organization members in this area by about 20-1, which is actually not half as bad a ratio as I had thought earlier, but still quite bad enough. The great majority of these troops owe no loyalty to the organization, and in fact do not realize that their orders are coming from us. So far, we've been keeping them busy day and night, and they haven't had time to ask too many questions. Organization members have been assigned to every military unit, from the company level up, and Henry, whom I saw briefly last night, seems to think we've got a pretty good grip on them. I hope so. I have had a chance to chat with a few of the troops we've been using for fuel recovery and utility repair crews. They seem to be impressed by three facts: that the government in Washington has totally lost control out here, that the blacks, both inside the military and outside, are a dangerous and unreliable element, and that they, with weapons and food, are a lot better off than the civilian population right now. But ideologically, they are in poor shape. Some of them are vaguely on our side. Others are still chock full of system brainwashing, and most are somewhere in between. The one thing that's keeping them in line now is the total absence of any alternate source of authority here. The system hasn't even gotten around to broadcasting appeals for loyalty aimed at our troops, probably because that would constitute an admission to the rest of the country just how big our win here has been. The official system line at the moment is that the situation is well under control, and the racist gangsters in California, that's us, will soon be rounded up or liquidated. Since we've been broadcasting appeals to revolt aimed at their troops day and night, and have also been giving a picture of the situation here much rosier than it actually is, the system's story sounds pretty hollow. Instead of denying our claims, the system has simply started jamming our broadcasts, which is probably their shrewdest course. The next entry is dated July 14th. The first substantial shipment of food entered the metro area today. A convoy of 60-odd big tractor trailers full of fresh produce from the San Joaquin Valley. They unloaded at 30 emergency distribution points we've now got manned in the white sections. But it was like trying to fill the ocean with a thimble. We need at least 5 times as much food every day just to maintain the white population at a bare subsistence level. There are still large stocks of non-perishable food in warehouses here, even though all the grocery stores have been looted bare. As soon as we're a little better organized and have located and inventoried it all, we can use this warehoused food to supplement the incoming fresh food. Meanwhile, there have been nasty incidents at several warehouses where we've had to shoot a number of people who wouldn't take no for an answer. The really nasty business is what we're running into in the black and racially mixed areas, though. I've spent the last 2 days directing salvage crews in areas which the troops have just finished clearing. The job of the troops is to separate the blacks from the rest of the population and confine them in controlled access areas until they can be convoyed out of our enclave. It's done in a quite simple and straightforward manner. A black holding area is designated, having been chosen for its proximity to a freeway heading east, and for the ease with which all exits from the area can be blocked. Tanks and machine gun crews take up positions at these exits. Then a sweep through surrounding neighborhoods begins, converging on the designated holding area. Groups of infantry are preceded by sound trucks, which repeatedly broadcast an announcement such as, "All blacks must assemble immediately for food and water supplies at the Martin Luther King Elementary School on 47th Street. Any black found north of 43rd Street after 1 p.m. will be shot on sight. All blacks must assemble," and so on. At first, groups of blacks tried to stand their ground and defy the troops, apparently under the impression that the honkies wouldn't actually shoot them. At this point, there is an editorial note to the reader. Honky was one of many derogatory slang terms referring to a white person, which was used by Negroes in the 3 decades prior to the Great Revolution. Its origin is uncertain. They discovered their mistake quite soon, however, and the word spread quickly. Most blacks moved along the streets leading into the designated areas, a block or two ahead of the slowly advancing infantry, who made quick searches of each building as they came abreast of it. Blacks who had not already vacated the premises were roughly driven into the streets at bayonet point. If they put up any resistance at all, they were shot on the spot, and the sound of this occasional gunfire helped to keep the other blacks moving along. There have so far been only about 6 instances of blacks with contraband firearms barricading themselves in buildings and shooting at our troops. Whenever this happens, the troops bypass the occupied building and call in a tank, which riddles the building with cannon and machine gun fire. Once again, it's a damned good thing the civilian population was disarmed by the system years ago. If more blacks had guns, there'd be no way we could deal with them, considering the disparity in numbers. My salvage crews move in right behind the infantry. Our job is to inventory and secure all essential supplies and facilities, gasoline and bulk quantities of other fuels, non-perishable food, medical supplies, heavy transport vehicles, certain industrial facilities, and so on. The blacks have pretty well cleaned out all the food in their areas, and they've mindlessly destroyed a lot of the other things we're looking for, although we are finding a lot of things they've missed, including more than 40 tons of dried fish meal in a pet food plant just this morning. The stuff doesn't taste very good, but this one batch will supply the minimum protein requirements of 100,000 people for a week. And yesterday we ran across 30,000 gallons of liquid chlorine, which is needed for water purification. We also recovered most of the drug inventories of a hospital and 2 clinics, in which the drug storerooms were still intact even after rioting blacks had ransacked the buildings. We also found gruesome evidence of one way in which the blacks have solved their food shortage: cannibalism. They began by setting up barricades in one main street to stop cars driven by whites, apparently as early as Tuesday of last week. The unfortunate whites were dragged from their cars, taken into a nearby black restaurant, butchered, cooked, and eaten. Later, the blacks organized hunting parties and made raids into white areas. In the cellar of one black apartment building, we found a scene of indescribable horror, attesting to the success of these raids. I and a crew of my men noticed a commotion in front of the building as we finished checking the looted shambles of an adjacent warehouse and came out onto the street. A group of GIs milling around the entrance were obviously distressed about something. One of them came running out of the apartment building and began retching and vomiting on the sidewalk. Then another, with a grim expression on his face, led a young white girl out of the building. She was about 10 years old, naked, filthy, and in an obvious state of shock. As soon as I pushed my way into the building, I recoiled from the horrible stench which permeated the place. Putting a handkerchief over my nose and mouth didn't seem to help, but with the aid of my flashlight, I descended the cellar stairs past two more GIs who were coming up. In the arms of one of them was a silently staring white child of about 4, alive but apparently too weak to walk. The cellar, which was illuminated by 2 kerosene lanterns hanging from steam pipes, had been converted into a human slaughterhouse by the blacks in the apartment building. The floor was slippery with half-congealed blood. There were washtubs full of stinking entrails and others filled with severed heads. 4 tiny human haunches dangled overhead from wires. On a wooden workbench beneath one of the lanterns, I saw the most terrible thing I have ever seen. It was the butchered and partly dismembered body of a teenaged girl. Her blue eyes stared emptily at the ceiling, and her long golden hair was matted with the blood which had rushed from the gaping wound in her throat. I retched and stumbled back up the stairs and out into the light again. I could not make myself go back into that awful cellar, but I sent 2 of my crew with cameras and lights down there to make a thorough photographic record. The photos will be useful for troop indoctrination. From one of the GIs outside the building, I learned that parts of at least 30 children, all white, had been found in the cellar, along with the 2 who were still alive. They had been tied to a pipe in one corner. In the rear courtyard of the building was an improvised barbecue grill and a large pile of small human bones, thoroughly gnawed. We took photographs of the courtyard, too. I have been working in mostly black areas, but I have also heard some pretty bad stories from our people who have been in white and Chicano areas. No cases of cannibalism by whites or Chicanos have been reported. The blacks are a race apart in this respect. But there's been a lot of killing and fights over food. And there have been some grisly atrocities where gangs of blacks have invaded white areas and taken over white homes, especially in the wealthier districts where the homes are more isolated from one another. On the positive side, in some of the predominantly white middle class and working class neighborhoods, whites have banded together to protect themselves from incursions by blacks and Chicanos. This is a refreshing development, but surprising in view of the way the morons out here have been voting in recent years. Is it possible that years of Jewish brainwashing have failed to take hold in the white masses? Actually, I'm afraid it has taken hold in all too many cases. In the racially mixed neighborhoods, for example, the whites have suffered terribly in the last 10 days, and they've made virtually no effort to protect themselves. Without guns, of course, self-defense is pretty much a matter of numbers and the will to survive. Although the whites are badly outnumbered in only a few mixed neighborhoods, they seem to have lost the feeling of identity and unity which the blacks and Chicanos still have. Most of all, though, many of them seem to be convinced that any effort at self-defense would be racist, and they fear being thought of as racists or thinking of themselves that way, more than they fear death. Even when gangs of blacks took their children away or raped their women before their eyes, they offered no significant resistance. Really sick. It's hard for me to feel sorry for whites who won't even try to protect themselves, and it's even harder for me to understand why we should take chances and knock ourselves out to save such brainwashed scum from the fate they richly deserve. And yet it is in the mixed areas that we're having the most trouble and taking the most chances. We are reluctant to fire on crowds where we may kill whites as well as non-whites, and the bastards apparently realize this and are taking advantage of it. In some neighborhoods, we're meeting so much opposition that it's nearly impossible to achieve our goal of separating the various racial groups into enclaves. Another big problem in trying to achieve racial separation is that so many people in this area cannot easily be classified as white or non-white. The process of mongrelization has gone so far in this country, and there are so many swarthy, frizzy-haired characters of all sizes and shapes running around that one doesn't know where to draw the line. Nevertheless, we've got to draw the line somewhere, and soon. There is no way we can feed everybody in our area, and if we're to avoid mass starvation among the whites, we must separate them into clearly defined areas soon where electricity, water, food, and other essentials are available. And we must move everyone else out of our area, one way or another. The longer we delay, the more unruly the public will become. Actually, we've done pretty well at concentrating the blacks. About 80% of them are sealed in 4 small enclaves now. And I understand that the first mass convoy of them is heading east tonight. But for the rest, about all we have really done is immobilize the population so they can't move from one neighborhood to another. We certainly don't have them under control, and so far as I'm aware, we've not even begun mass arrests or taken any other action against Jews and other hostile elements yet. Let's get on with this now. The next diary entry is dated July 19th, 1993. For the past 5 days, I've been witnessing what surely must be one of the biggest mass migrations in history, the evacuation of the blacks and mestizos and boat people from Southern California. We've been marching them to the east at a rate of better than 1 million a day, and there still seems to be no end to them. I learned at our unit meeting this evening, however, that tomorrow is expected to be the last full day of evacuation. After that, it'll just be a matter of sending them across the lines in batches of a few thousand at a time as we round up strays and finish separating some areas which are still racially mixed. My men and I have had the responsibility of finding transportation for those unable to make the trek on foot. We started with flatbed trucks and large tractor-trailer rigs able to haul a couple of hundred people at a time, and we ended up using every delivery van and panel truck we could find in or near the evacuated black and Chicano neighborhoods, nearly 6,000 trucks altogether. At first, we tried to do a careful job of making sure each truck had just enough fuel in its tank to make the one-way trip into enemy territory, but that took too long, and so we settled for trying to be reasonably sure that each vehicle had at least enough fuel for the trip. Late yesterday, we began running out of trucks, and so all day today, we've been using passenger cars. I broke up the roughly 300 men under me into squads of 10. Each squad rounded up approximately 50 young black volunteers, with the promise of food, who claim they are experienced at jumping the ignition on cars. Then our squads began ferrying every parked car from Volkswagens to Cadillacs, which can be started and whose fuel gauge indicates at least a quarter of a tank of gasoline, into the packed debarkation areas. There our black car thief volunteers hustle a pregnant negress or an elderly cripple behind the wheel, pack the vehicle with as many pickaninnies and miscellaneous lame, sick, and halt non-whites as it can possibly carry, sometimes piling them on roofs and fenders, and send it on its way, then back for more cars. I have been surprised to see how callous our volunteer blacks are toward their own people. Some of the older blacks who haven't been able to fend for themselves are obviously near the point of death from starvation and dehydration, Yet our volunteers handle them so roughly and pack them so tightly into the cars that it makes me flinch to watch them. When one overloaded Cadillac started onto the eastbound freeway with a lurch this morning, an ancient Negro lost his grip and fell off the roof, landing headfirst on the pavement and crushing his skull like an egg. The blacks who had just loaded the car roared with laughter. It was apparently the funniest thing they've seen in a long time. Our logistics have been terrible. We've violated every security rule in the book and taken some extraordinary risks. There were hundreds of times when the blacks could have jumped us because we were spread so thin and often obliged to work deep within their jam-packed enclaves without backup personnel to rescue us in the event of trouble. I really don't have enough men to handle this job properly, and we've all been working at least 18 hours a day, often not stopping to rest until we're so tired we're stumbling. It's a good thing tomorrow is the last day, because I don't think my men can last much longer, or our luck either. What we've accomplished so far is really quite remarkable, though. We've moved out approximately 500,000 non-whites who couldn't possibly have made it on foot. Each and every one of these is now the responsibility of the system to feed and house and clothe and keep out of trouble. Together with the 7 million or so able-bodied blacks and Chicanos we're sending them, that's quite a responsibility. This whole evacuation amounts to a new form of warfare, demographic war. Not only are we getting the non-whites out of our area, but we're doing two additional things which should pay off for us later by getting them into the enemy's area. We're overloading the system's already strained economy, and we're making life next to intolerable for the whites in the border areas. Even after the evacuees have been dispersed around the country, they will constitute about a 25% increase in the average non-white population density outside California. Even the most brainwashed white liberals should find this increased dose of brotherhood hard to swallow. On my way to the unit meeting about an hour ago, I stopped at an overlook above the main evacuation route out of Los Angeles. It was after sunset, but still light enough to see well, and I was awed by the sight of the enormous stream of colored life moving slowly to the east. As far as I could see in either direction, the unwholesome flood crept along. Later, we'll switch on the street lamps along the freeway, and the march will go on all night. Then, in the heat of the morning, the evacuation of the able-bodied ones will be reined in enough so that we will have room on the freeway for our vehicles to get through again. We found out at the beginning that when we tried keeping the marchers going during the day, they dropped like flies. The sight of that huge, flowing swarm of non-whites left me with an overwhelming feeling of relief that it was moving away from us, out of our area. And I shuddered with revulsion at the thought of being at the other end of the evacuation route and seeing that swarm moving toward me into my area. If the system bosses had the option, they'd turn the niggers back at the border with machine guns. But with the border manned with mostly non-white troops, it is pretty hard to give the order to fire on that non-white flood. Since the inundation began, they haven't been able to figure out any way to stop it. They are trapped by their own propaganda line, which maintains that each of those creatures is an equal, with human dignity and so forth, and must be treated accordingly. Yes, sir, things are looking up here, and I'm sure they're looking blacker and blacker elsewhere. The proof of that is the counterflow of white refugees into our area from the east. From 100 or so a day 10 days ago, their numbers have grown to several thousand a day. Our border guards have processed a total of more than 25,000 whites coming across the line up to this afternoon. Most of these, it seems, are simply running to get away from the black troops and the black and Chicano evacuees who have flooded the enemy's border areas. If it is easier for them to run west than east, they run west.